All right, Kim Gordon, thanks very much. It is 12 minutes after 12 o'clock here on a Monday afternoon. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch. Steve Bertrand here. Thanks very much for joining us. And we'll talk to Philip Weiss of Seyfarth Shaw at Work a little bit later about the survey that they did of the companies they work with about employee and employer expectations of the Trump administration, or what sorts of policies they think will have the biggest impact on them. It's not a plus or minus, but how what they think will impact them the most. So we'll kick that around. Also, Randy Schaefer from the Tribune comes by to talk about social media, but we start usually on Mondays with Chicago Inno, and it's really hard not to say the Inno boys, but Will Flanagan, once again, is, well, he's traveling across the country with his dog, right? Writing a book like Travels with Charlie?
Exactly, yes.
So he's not here. That's Jim Dahlke. He is. And Karis Husted, who is, well, also probably generally accepted to be more intelligent and a better writer than Will, is in the suit.
I think you're yes on all those accounts.
All right, I won't deny it.
I think it was kind of funny that Dahlke was just nodding and not speaking there for a second, like there'd be no evidence. All right, let's start with this Cards Against Humanity. I mentioned to Bill and Wendy that they had an ad. I didn't see it, but it was pregame, right? It was before the football game, and
yeah, it was during the pregame show on Fox Chicago, and they actually had an ad that was just 30 seconds with a potato that said advertisement on it.
No sound. I thought, because when you guys tipped me off, I thought, well, we'll get some sound and play. There was no sound. It was just a potato there for 30 seconds. And as is their wont, and they put out this pretty hilarious blog posting or online posting today about it.
Yeah, the blog post was sort of pretty satirical, just about this sort of state of advertising, and they sort of wrote this blog post about how the ad was so expensive it made them go bankrupt, which was not true. We reached out to them today, and they said the cost of them in the low
five figures. Yeah, so it was sort of interesting because a lot of people weren't sure how to respond to it. There are a lot of people responding on social media, like, why did I just see an advertisement of a potato?
Right.
There were some tech news sites that picked it up saying Cards Against Humanity is bankrupt. Now they don't exist anymore, but they basically use this blog post to satirize the media and marketing frenzy around Super Bowl ads.
Well, I like that they listed sort of the mistakes they made, and they noticed one of them was to not mention the name of their product.
But I mean, that's just such typical Cards Against Humanity, right? Like, this is the same company that mailed literal bull feces to people when they just paid money to Cards Against Humanity. They also dug a hole in the middle of the ground as long as people continue to pay them. So, I mean, they're sort of this irreverent voice in the gaming community, but it's also a voice that I like totally love. And it was sort of awesome to see this regional Super Bowl ad kind of generate some buzz online.
And so did they do it just for a joke, or they're getting something out of it, right? Are they getting something out of it?
I think that they're mostly did it as a joke, and as Jim said, I mean, they kind of exist as a little bit of an antagonist to whatever the status quo is.
They got money to burn, don't they? They've just got money. They've got money growing out of their ears.
It's the number one card game on Amazon. Right. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, I don't know what they're bringing in on it, but it's obviously doing very well.
Do you realize how many 30-second ads they could buy on this show for what they spent on that Super Bowl ad?
You got to reach out.
They know where I am. They come to me. All right, let's talk Uber too, because I love this story. The city of Chicago is being sued, right? Was that filed last week?
Correct.
So the idea is that I'm sorry to interrupt you, but the idea is that, you know, the very strict Uber rules for what can and cannot be done, and one of the things is you can't advertise on the car or in the car, and there's a guy who's got an advertising business who is suing.
Exactly, yeah. So the startup is called Vugo, and they do just that, in-vehicle advertising in rideshare. So think Uber and Lyft. And they were a startup, actually, that launched in Chicago and had to leave because of regulations that the city passed back in 2014 that made basically their business model illegal in the city of Chicago.
What is it? They give you an iPad, or right?
So
they give the driver an iPad?
They hook the drivers up with iPads, or they direct the drivers to buy like really cheap ones, like $100, not iPads, a tablet. Yeah, basically. And then they put it on the seat rest and hook up with advertising companies to show ads within your ride sharing service. So basically, it gives Uber drivers an extra few hundred bucks a month to
like
earn.
They say, right?
Yeah, so you earn a few hundred bucks of extra income. They had to relocate. They are now, and the startup is in LA, and they are suing. They've also have a lawsuit against New York currently underway right now, and just filed a suit against the city of Chicago last week.
And what does the city argue? I mean, I guess they're licensing them, right, so they can have some control over it.
So really what happened in 2014 was this was clearly a protection for the taxi cabs, because if you've ever been in a Chicago taxi cab, you're very aware that you're seeing advertisements inside the cab and outside the cab.
I think I remember a time when you couldn't do that in cabs either.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think what happened was this was one of a smaller provision that was sort of tucked into a broader rideshare regulation. And it's something that at the time I don't think Uber was really concerned with. I don't think they're really concerned with it now. There just wasn't, advertising just wasn't really a huge part of Uber's business model.
And they're not getting anything. They're getting no cash out of this.
No, yeah.
And so the guy who's suing, the Vugo, argues free speech. Now, I don't know if he's got – I'm no constitutional lawyer, but that might be an uphill.
Yeah, he's looking at commercial free speech and it's sort of how it's being regulated against private – inside of private vehicles. I mean, how can you regulate what somebody puts inside their own car? And then it's sort of just looking at discrimination between how they're doing taxis versus ride-sharing. So it'll be an interesting case to sort of follow there. They filed the suit with the Liberty Justice Center, so we shall see kind of how this turns out.
Have the number of taxis gone down? Has anyone done a story on that?
Yeah, I know that it's been a really contentious battle, and taxi drivers are definitely losing money to Uber and Lyft. And so I think what's kind of interesting, though, is like you're seeing a lot more people using Uber and Lyft as their full-time jobs, which is never kind of how Uber or Lyft imagined their service to be. They always advertise it as a side hustle for drivers to make a little extra cash. But there was just a Bloomberg story about Uber drivers who are actually sleeping in their cars to make sure that they can get the most hours possible to make the most money. And so I think it's interesting because we're seeing people start to use these ride hailing services as their full-time jobs. And so how do you, you know, help those people make a little extra money, because the amount they can make per hour as advertised is not always exactly what they can make.
So the Uber drivers are going to become taxi drivers.
I think they have been.
Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, is that what, if they're living in their car, if they're in their cars all the time to always be available, they've just sort of changed the office, right?
Exactly. I mean, in that Bloomberg story, it was so interesting the way that, you know, an Uber driver could live in a far south suburb but need to come into the city center to make it to do the trips. And so it basically is not worth their time and money to drive back home and pay the gas mileage it takes to get back out of the city.
I've used Uber a few times up where I live. I live in Deerfield. Not a lot, maybe three or four times. Every time it has been by someone who's at least 30 miles away, who they live. Like one time it was from Maywood. Another time it was from the south side of Chicago. So that exact sort of thing. All right. Jim Dahlke here, Kairos Husted as well from Chicago Inno. We're going to help the downstate entrepreneurs coming up. And then we're going to go into your kitchen coming up on the Business Lunch. It's 1222. This is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Chicago Inno in the studio, Kairos Husted and Jim Dahlke. And we got a lot to talk about. So let's go rapid fire. This home chef company. So the Blue Apron is the big one. They send you the ingredients for your dinner. You make it. My wife and I did one. I can't remember the name of it now. It wasn't Home Chef or Blue Apron. And it was
Plated
kind of,
is another one.
Yeah, it wasn't Plated either. It was whatever it was. It was nice enough. But you know, like any of those things, if you don't use every one, you find it's like Lucille Ball in the treadmill. The ingredients start piling up, and you know, we make our own food with our own recipes, but didn't work. This Home Chef, though, is getting big. They're from Chicago, and they are just moving in across the street here at the Wrigley Building. I like that.
Yeah, right across the way, 30,000 square feet right across the street from us.
And the 14th floor, which I didn't know until now, that's the one with the walkway, so they can walk 14 floors above and look down on all of us.
Exactly, yeah. And it's sort of atypical of a Chicago startup. I mean, this is a very Silicon Valley kind of idea. You know, meal kit delivery, Blue Apron, obviously sort of leading the way in that. And Home Chef now is the second biggest meal kit delivery service in the U.S.
Second by far, but still second.
Right. So, yeah, Blue Apron's still the leader of the pack.
But they've got hundreds of people working for them.
Yeah, they've got a research and development center. They've got a distribution center, and then their office headquartered here in Chicago. Then they've got other distribution centers in Georgia and California. So about 800 people total employed for Home Chef.
So, Karis, what do you think? Is this the way we're going to eat in the future?
I know. It kind of seems like that.
It does.
I definitely think that there's space for growth and actually space for Home Chef to kind of get up on Blue Apron a little bit. Blue Apron had a little bit of some labor issues. They had some employment issues, some violent employees, some poor workplace habits. And so that was pretty bad PR for them. So I think for people who are interested in this, I could see them moving their loyalties to Home Chef.
Yeah, and Loyal, it's a local company, so that's nice. And I love the idea. It just didn't quite click for us where we were, but we'll see how that goes. Tell me about this. I grew up south of I-80. And, you know, a lot of people south of I-80 have a real chip on their shoulder about Chicago and the suburbs. And now there's this new incubator that's going to help us little people down there, right?
Right. Well, University of Illinois.
What do you mean, right? We're not little people, guys.
we're helping you now, I promise. So University of Illinois just got two grants. One is going to basically use University of Illinois resources to help small business owners and startups that are located below I-80. So, like, your business address has to be below I-80. You're not going to get help if you're
And the idea
that.
Is that, that they have not had as much access to capital?
They haven't had as much access to capital resources. You see moves like Caterpillar coming to Chicago from Peoria.
ADM did the same thing, right?
Exactly. And so I think this is sort of a way for University of Illinois to give back to the community that they've grown up in and really flourished
nice.
In.
Nice. And so we'll see where that is. But so that is new people can apply for that funding, or how quite does that work?
Right. So University of Illinois is getting the funding, and then they're going to create programs that can provide direct assistance to business owners.
All right. Cool. Well, follow that. One other one I want to talk about. When we just recently were in the market for some real estate, and when you do, you go on Zillow and you look at what the comps are, what it's worth, all of that stuff. I had no idea there was no such sort of software for commercial real estate in the city or elsewhere, and that's going to change with any luck.
Yeah, this startup is called Truss, and they are sort of a brand new startup here in Chicago, built from a former founder of TrustWave, a cybersecurity startup that sold for over $700
million. These are big money guys, right?
Yeah, this is a serial entrepreneur who is back with a new startup, and really, like you said, building the Zillow for commercial real estate. The tools that you have when you're looking for your own personal apartment or home, a lot of them don't really exist in the commercial real estate space, so Truss is really doing that, but they're sort of going beyond that, beyond just search. It's really a comprehensive platform. They're incorporating virtual reality to help you sort of see the space before you walk in. They're going to let you do negotiations on their platform. They're going to let you sign your the lease there on the platform as well. So they're kind of making an all-in-one shop for commercial real estate.
And in 5 years, they say this is going to be the way it's done.
That's the plan. It's going to be very focused on virtual reality. So really, I mean, eventually you're going to want to go into the building and check it out for yourself. But if you can see 5-10 different spaces in VR first, you can
right.
narrow it down to a couple.
We've talked about that a couple times on this show when it comes to residential real estate. You know that the fish is almost on the hook by the time they go in the house, because you've seen so much and you are so aware now before you even get the walkthrough that, you know, that the important stuff is the VR before that. So Truss is sort of going to see the same thing.
Exactly, yeah.
All right, Jim Dahlke, Kars Husted from Chicago Inno. Go spend the rest of your week at work. And thanks for coming by today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks.
Thank you, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN 1236. Randy Schaefer is in the studio. She writes about social media for the Chicago Tribune. And, I would imagine that Super Bowl Sunday is a pretty big day for social media.
It kind of is. I'm not sure if you've noticed that, but I did notice that a little bit.
And in fact, at one point, I think it was right after the game, they were talking about how many tweets. Was it 41,000 tweets per something?
Per something. There were a lot.
Per minute? Was it? Yeah, per minute. Yeah. All right. So today's the day everyone sort of digests and figures things out. What was the reaction on social media to some of the ads and some of the things that happened?
Well, the reaction to the game was kind of what happened.
Right.
A lot of people were kind of stunned by that overtime win by the Patriots.
Did the Patriots end up winning? They did.
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
They
okay,
did.
Good.
Kind of unexpected, but also a little bit more fallout. Things were a little bit political. Social media took to analyzing Lady Gaga's halftime show with some of the subtle things she did in there. She performed Born This Way, which is kind of about inclusivity.
Yeah, so
you want to sing it for me?
No. I'm following all this stuff, and you know, people saying, was she political or was she not? Of course she's going to sing Born This Way,
of
right?
Course,
I mean, that
right.
doesn't really mean that's not a sign of something.
Right, and I heard that she was told to kind of keep things not political, keep things on topic.
Right.
And I think she did a pretty great way of kind of bringing everyone together instead of being divisive with her show.
I think there was one lyric where she was talking about stay, and she seemed to embrace a Hispanic woman.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
as close as it got, as
yeah,
far as I could see.
Yeah, I thought that was very tastefully done.
How about some of the ads? Now, Anheuser-Busch, we talked about this Friday on the show. They made an ad that would have been, you know, any other year, this feel-good, pro-America kind of story. It was about Adolphus Bush, I think, coming to the United States and being an immigrant, being unwelcomed at first. But given all the stuff that's going on, they claim they were making the ad before, but given all of that, it became kind of the political hot potato of the night.
Yeah, that and also the Coca-Cola ad, which is something
Coca-Cola's done in the past.
Yeah, yeah. They've always featured ads of people in other countries speaking other languages while drinking Coca-Cola. But this year, especially in light of the election, these kind of things became super political with calls and hashtags on Twitter for things like boycott Audi, boycott Budweiser, boycott Coca-Cola, et cetera.
There was a guy at Breitbart, one of the editors, said these commercials have been a bonanza of leftist activism, two immigration commercials, a feminist commercial, now an eco-wacko commercial. Am I missing anything?
And it's kind of strange because, yeah, like we just said, these commercials have always kind of been around calls for inclusivity, but just in light of the recent Super Bowl, it's taken on a whole new alt-right spin.
Okay, so I'm going to propose something and be subjected to the text, but I don't mean it in a political way. But if you think of it, I was talking with a buddy of mine last night via texting, that it would be much easier to make a commercial contrary to Donald Trump's stated positions than it would be in favor of it. Does that make sense? I mean, what would you have that would be an ad, say, you know, supporting his immigration ban? I guess it would be, you know, police protecting people. I'm not quite sure. I guess the arguments just lend themselves to sort of views contrary to what he stands for.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and then also, you know, a lot of these brands do business globally. So they're not going to, it would kind of be bad for business, you would think, for them to shut down immigration and, you know, anything.
But if a guy said, all right, I want to make a pro Donald Trump political issue campaign, I guess it would be a law and order sort of thing, I suppose.
I'm trying to picture this in my mind.
Yeah, I know. It just seems like the way the arguments are set up that it would be harder to do that. It's not a judgment on one side or the other. It's just sort of the way it is. All right. Tell me about this guy. Let me find his name here. Daniel John Sobieski, 68-year-old guy. I think he lives on the south side of Chicago.
Yeah,
maybe?
Over by Midway.
By Midway, right. In the shadow of the plains. And he is a tweeting storm.
He is a Twitter bot, but an actual person, not a real bot. This is a fascinating story that the Washington Post ran, and we actually have it on our site right now, the Chicago Tribune, if you guys are interested in checking it out, anyone listening. But this Chicagoan, he tweets more than 1,000 times a day using schedulers. And so he's a very conservative voice. He's very pro-Donald Trump. He has two accounts, and they were two of the five top Donald Trump accounts leading up to the election. And it's just kind of fascinating to read this guy's story and to kind of learn a little bit more about the man behind the bot.
Okay, so I just called up his Twitter page. 1 minute ago, he tweeted, Hillary Clinton ignored Nigeria's terrorist group. And he's always got pictures that help, right? Help
yes,
pick up followers.
Yes, he has a folder of them on his desktop.
3 minutes ago, Emailgate disqualifies Hillary Clinton for U.S. president. 6 minutes ago, adopt Mexico's immigration policy, American thinker. 8 minutes ago, another one about sending someone to jail, not just impeached. So he's tweeting more than a human could, right? He sets up these schedulers.
Yeah.
So they're coming up every couple minutes, and he does it in a way that really creates a great following for him.
Yeah, and these schedules, they also recycle old tweets. So there's no possible way he could sit there and type 24 hours a day every 3 minutes. So these are multiple tweets that are going across multiple times as well.
And what's in it for him? What's this about?
He gets his voice across. He gets attention. He gets to be heard. I know he writes for a conservative, I wasn't sure if it was a blog or a news, kind of a newsy outlet type of thing, think pieces. And so this kind of gets his brand out there a little bit as well. Kind of draws in some of the attention of like-minded people as well.
And so, right, so he's sending, first of all, the volume of tweets, so he's going to get more attention. He's putting on significant hashtags, he's getting retweets and all of that, and he's become sort of this force, but does he consider himself, he's not just some guy sitting there eating his cornflakes and tweeting, right? He considers himself a political player.
Right, he considers himself a very strong voice. And so that's what's so kind of fascinating about it is these bots have such a huge influence, especially leading up to the election. And they were way more conservative than liberal.
Well, that's the thing. So, right, so the Democrats are kind of far behind when it comes to this.
Right, and that's, you took the words right out of Daniel John Sobieski's mouth. So what he said is the conservatives have this nailed and the liberals not so much.
That's what he said. It's the sort of thing that the liberals should pick up on?
I'm not entirely sure. It kind of depends on the message you're trying to get across.
I guess, because I see these, and if I see them coming that fast, you know, I've got a couple of people I follow on Twitter, and when they're after too many tweets, I just
mute them.
I mute them.
Right.
So this is, you know, and I don't tend to, I think, agree with what John's tweeting about here. But if I got this many and they were this sort of loud, I would not follow them.
Right, and whether you agree with the subject matter or not, I think the frequency, in my opinion, is a little annoying.
Yeah, but we're both wrong, aren't we? Because he's had great
Apparently,
success.
Apparently, it works for him, so.
All right, so Donald Trump was tweeting this morning that he makes up his own mind, right? Or something to that effect.
Yes.
I call the shots, because that was after a New York Times story that said maybe Steve Bannon was calling some of the shots, and Saturday Night Live did something similar. So he does a lot of tweeting, and sometimes he'll pull back or re-edit. People get a big kick out of when he misspells something and then he corrects it, which is something we all do.
Right.
But there was just an article in U.S. News, I think it was, about the fact that his tweets are becoming or will be sort of the presidential record, right? So he can't pull them back.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is actually the Presidential Records Act, so it's very official. This is real legislation created after the whole
Watergate mess,
yes,
right?
Yes, after the whole Nixon debacle. And it creates really strict rules for presidential records. And, you know, back during the Nixon era, we didn't have Twitter and we didn't have easy delete buttons. Now it's a little bit different, but this Record Act still stands. And what it says is that all of Donald Trump's tweets are considered presidential records, which according to this act means they can't be deleted. So it kind of creates a gray area when Trump or his administrative assistants tweet something, realize there's a typo, and then delete it. And is that legal? Is it not legal? There's still copies of it somewhere. It's the internet. Nothing really ever
goes away. If they wanted to create the archive, there would be access to it somehow, right?
Right, you would think. And so this is actually something that even the U.S. National Archives, they've weighed in and they've said, yes, tweets are presidential records, but we're not really sure if the Presidential Records Act applies to them.
It's just kind of an interesting thing and one of the new pieces of the new world win with Donald Trump. I mean, he uses his own Twitter handle so effectively and so often and so interestingly that we'll just see how it follows.
Yeah. And I mean, technology moves so fast. By the time they get this figured out, I'm sure we'll be off of Twitter and onto something else.
And Don will be sitting here in a hologram telling us
yes.
what to do. It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Randy Schaefer from the Trib. Thanks for coming by. All right. Thank you very much, Steve Alexander. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Philip Weiss is in the studio, Managing Director of Seyfarth Shaw at Work. He comes by from time to time. Mr. Weiss, thank you for coming in today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
All right. So let's break down the football game. No, wait, that's not it, is it?
Well, that's a dramatic topic as well.
You guys had an interesting, so you work with all, how many different companies do you work with?
We work with 600 to 700 companies a year.
Okay.
So over the last decade, it's been in the thousands.
And so after the election, you went to these companies or to many of them and said, what policies of Donald Trump do you expect to be impacted by? And it's not a which ones do you like or which ones do you not like. It's as you run your business, which of these sorts of things do you think is going to have an impact, right?
Exactly. And we try to do this every 4 years or so, or at least when there's a new administration office. It helps us, Steve, because then when we're training these companies, these managers, employees, we can say, we know this matters. Let's talk about what it means on the ground. And sometimes the answers are pretty eye-opening.
Yeah, I'm interested in, and we'll get to it. You know me, I always like the difference, the view from the managers versus the more rank-and-file employees. But as far as the most impactful issue, the people said it was tariffs, right?
It was. First time we've ever heard that in the history of asking the question, what policies do you think will affect you or your job? And it's partly because it was a topic on the campaign trail. It's been invoked by the administration as a potential foreign policy tool.
Right.
Pay for the wall, impose taxes. That's rattled a lot of people, both at the employee and manager level, partly because the economy is so globally connected. So if you're not trading with a country or a company outside the U.S., you're probably somewhere in that supply chain quite often.
So this is one that they're worried about.
Concerned about 38% of those polled at both the manager and employee levels said this could be significant. They feel a real concern, and it was a negative concern, not a positive hope.
And so what do you tell companies, I mean, to... Do you advise that they lobby against it? Do you advise that they prepare for it? Or what does a guy advise them?
You know, that's the two pieces of advice that come to mind first.
Right.
Call your congressperson. Always a good idea, whether you're speaking on behalf of an entire company or you have a personal stake. But second of all, plan ahead. We've got a lot of companies that are already, including in Chicago, creating a secondary stream of suppliers. So if they're trading with one company in one country, is there an alternative in case they need to go somewhere else based on what the administration decides?
Okay, if I can be Donald Trump right here, then if they're looking at a second alternative, maybe that one's in this country, and that could be a win for this country.
Yeah, it could be, unless, of course, they went outside the U.S. for other reasons, such as dramatically different cost basis.
Right, right.
Or a specific kind of expertise. Quite often, they're not looking at the U.S. They're looking at all the options and picking the best one so they can maintain their margins.
Okay, second concern, most concerned or most stated concern, is about deregulation. And this is one where it differs from the bosses to the regular worker.
Yeah, it was really interesting, Steve. We didn't see a split along party lines, though we didn't ask people. We didn't see
because you wouldn't, Philip. That'd be a bad form for you.
Thank you for knowing that. We've made a lot of progress over the last few months of being together.
You've beaten it into me.
Tremendous progress. And we didn't see even, frankly, a rural city divide, which you've read a lot about in the wake of this election.
Sure.
It's a manager-employee divide. Managers, by and large, said what you might expect. Less red tape, less regulation, more growth, more profits. And in some cases, they said, well, that will eventually mean more hiring. Employees felt a little differently.
Right.
They often looked at regulations as something that was in their interest, protecting their safety, their rights, their pay. A great example of that is a form you may have heard of called the EEO-1 form. It's a form that a lot of companies have to complete that lists out what people are paid by job title, by category. Under the Obama administration, one of the goals was to expand that form to require a lot more information. The new administration is looking to do away with the new EEO-1 form. Well, bosses say, hey, that's a lot less paperwork.
Right. But let me speak for the employees, right? They're saying, wait a minute, this is how I find out if I'm fairly compensated.
That's it. The employees say, look, a little more paperwork is also a paper trail that our bosses should be using to show us they're paying us equally.
Right. And so do the workers have access to that form?
Well, that's a very good question. It's really a company form that is filed with the federal government. In some cases, employees have access to information, and others they don't.
Uh-huh.
What's also interesting is employees can talk about their wages with each other. So it's not as though employees are put in a silo or a cone of silence, but they're really focused on the fact that companies have got to make representations to the government, and they think it's a good thing.
Yeah, because I always lie in those conversations anyway, Philip.
About what you're paid?
Yeah.
Because you want it to look like it's a lot more than it is?
Yeah.
Okay, well, then you're not a good example of what we're encountering out there on the road.
Or as an honest employee. Oh, really? You do find that they share it and that's an effective?
Well, it's interesting because employees historically have thought we really shouldn't be talking about what we're paid. But that's one of these areas the federal government says you got to let people talk about their wages, the conditions of their work, et cetera. Employees are catching on. That's, however, not always the reason employers change their practices. It's these regulations.
Okay, one more. We're going to skip a couple and go down to immigration. So it's like the fifth greatest concern.
Fifth greatest.
But I'm interested because that's where the bosses and workers flip a little bit.
They do flip. I mean, they flip almost 100%, which is really interesting. Because when it comes to immigration limits, which you may have noticed is in the news of late.
Yes.
Employees tend to look at this as less immigration, less competition for my job.
Good for me.
Right. Less chance that I will lose an opportunity to someone coming in and taking a job.
Donald Trump's voters in many ways.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
However, managers, particularly the higher up you go, they have a very different view. They say you limit immigration, you limit our competitive advantage. They've got so many examples they've shared with us of people that came in that were the key factor in a new technology, new invention, or new product. We were actually training in Cambridge, and they take a lot of their graduates from MIT and Harvard.
Sure, sure.
And all the managers at those tech companies, bio companies in Cambridge, Mass, said to us, you know what, if you limit people coming in or you even disincentivize them from coming in, we're going to lose our advantage in this global economy.
Philip Weiss is the managing director of Seyfarth Shaw at Work. Thanks for coming by.
Good to see you.